The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
A seeker came to the temple and met with the teacher and asked, "Please teach me." And the teacher said, "Have you had your lentil soup?" "Yes, I have." "And go wash your bowl." And the seeker understood. I didn't change this story here for novelty or just to do something different. I did it because I want to point to something. Something that you may have realized or not, but this story that originated probably 1,200 years ago is alive here in this room right now. These people are human beings, or were human beings just like us, with deep longings and wish. Zen is a path to awakening. It is a way to seeing who you truly are beneath all the noise. Most of us move through our lives shaped by our habits, our constructions, and the way we see the world. And this practice helps us see that. And it helps us by looking, helps us to allow the opportunity to look deeply into what is here. This silence and this stillness, holding our bodies steady in these moments where we really want to scratch that itch. We really want to chase that thought. But coming back to our practice again and again, we get to see how our minds work. We get to see something incredible. When we look, the opportunity is there to see the entire Buddha Dharma, the entire teachings of the Buddha, all the ancestors, the teachings and the sutras, right here in a simple washing of the bowl. Simple cleaning the toilet, picking up maple saplings, brushing your teeth, laying your head on a pillow. These moments are not special. But that doesn't mean to degrade them or diminish them in any way. They're actually so special that a word like special leads us away from what is alive, right here and now. Each of us, I believe, at some point in our lives has tasted this, touched this. Maybe for a fraction of a second. Some vast, intimate stillness. Beyond the opinions and the judgments. That's not a special state. That is who you are. Before thought arises, before discernment and judgment. And this, as Ms. Melissa called it, a technology, allows us the opportunity to see this nothing special. This moment, right here, right now, when I'm talking, this moment when you're sitting and breathing, is complete. Nothing needs to be added. Nothing needs to be taken away. Any idea of something to be added or taken away is just a thought, just an idea. And if this moment is complete, that means you're complete. It's unbelievable. And that's a good thing because I don't want you to believe any of it. I want you to see it for yourself. This evening, as you practice into the night, as we will together, can you see that what is here is enough? Can this here be enough? Can you see that what you have always longed for in your deepest heart is right here, has always been here? A monk came to the temple and asked Xiaozhou, "Please teach me." Xiaozhou said, "Have you eaten your rice gruel?" "Yes, I have." "Then wash your bowl." And the monk understood. Thank you. So please make yourselves comfortable. Thank you, Aiden. And the folks in the middle line, if you could spread out like you did this morning. We have some time for a Dharma dialogue. Opportunity to ask any questions about my talk, what may be coming up for you in your practice. So please raise your hand if you have anything to share or any question. I haven't taken a poll. I don't know if it's my it's not my concern.
But it's your concern.
Yeah.
Tell us where that question's coming from.
Well, I read The Power of Now and books like that. There's so many that talk about how this technology is reaching more and more people. Mm. And at this time in humanity's evolution, it's really crucial that we apply that technology because it could determine the course of the Earth, but beyond the Earth. I feel a personal investment in that evolution, because I look back in history and I see moments where opportunities were wasted, where there was like one person who made a choice that was selfish, ignorant, greedy, hateful, and the whole world pays the price. Mm-hmm. So I wonder about the future, and I wonder about if we have a chance, if there's actually legitimate hope in this practice and in it reaching more people.
Mm.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's just wonderful for you.
Yeah.
Just to hear you speak to that, because I can feel my mind bifurcate a little bit into despair and hopefulness, right? And this is what I think many of us are dealing with. Way back in the day, there was a teacher named Joanna Macy, and we worked with her. My husband and I worked for her for a while. Incredible teaching about really facing into the despair. And this was, when was this? In the 80s, maybe? Just, you know, I think back, that was a long time ago. And similar stuff was coming up for people, right? And it was mostly about nuclear war. That was the main thing. And so we sat around in her workshops and we felt the despair. And it went deeper and deeper and deeper. And then these were one-day workshops. In the afternoon, she would turn it around and talk about despair. It's a little bit like what we're saying about anger leading to wisdom. It's a similar teaching that despair leads to empowerment. Right? When you really feel the despair for the world. And so we did, you know, however many years ago that was. I think our ancestors did too. And what if we made a difference? And one of the exercises she did, which I still think was amazing, there's a teaching, like a mythological teaching in Buddhism, that fetuses wait up in this place called Tushita Heaven, and they're looking down and trying to find a couple that they want to be part of in the family. And so, you know, they zero in on the people who are copulating. It's a great story. It makes sense to me about my own daughter. She had us go through, so think about when you were born, where, what your parents were like, the year as compared to 1945 when the first bombs were, or, you know, how old are you after that? And she turned it into this wonderful practice about deliberately owning who we happen to be, whether we're male, female, non-binary, whether we're white or black or brown, what religion we were born into, that all those things matter. And it's a little bit like what I was saying to Lily earlier, that only you can carry the karma of your life into the future. And karma, what I mean by karma, we talk about karma, it's not like being condemned to something, it's just the law of cause and effect. So you're saying, you know, one person did this terrible thing. I don't know who you're talking about, but I have a list. And right now, think of the suffering that just one person is causing for people along the border and people actually right here in Worcester getting arrested and put in camps. That's happening right now. So what can we do? What's our responsibility? How can we empower ourselves? That's what I'm sensing you're looking into. So it could just go to hell. That's one route. Or something could start happening. And I don't know. So the other thing in Zen practices, we say, we don't know what's going to happen, but we can be really present in this moment and wash our bowl. That's what we get to do.
And, you know, just to take off what Moses said about not knowing, you're doing something right now, very powerful, that you will never quite know how powerful it is. You won't know how it ripples through space and time. This moment right here that you're taking this time out of your life to do this very important work has an effect on the world. We say in our Bodhisattva vows, I vow to save, beings are numberless, I vow to save them. Right? This is how we save them. We one moment, one bowl at a time.
And there's something, you can see we're very excited by your comments. So you have a lot to say. We have to see too that the things we do in this moment, if we're attached to outcome, right? If we think we want a certain thing to happen, well, in a way, that's none of our business. I've been feeling it very strongly this weekend with all of you. I'm pretty sure that I won't be around in 50 years, but many of you will be. So I can only imagine what effect this retreat is going to have, the ripples in all of your lives that I will never know about. I have to just say, okay, wash my bowl, teach this retreat.
That makes sense. Mm-hmm. And how we can only ever take action or do anything in the present moment, and how the future, we want to be able to control the future or determine the future, but the only way to ever have any influence on it is being here and causing those chain reactions in our own context, in our own identity.
Exactly.
I like that.
Yeah, and I gotta say, when I was 20 years old, if I had thought that 50 years later I would be a Zen teacher, I could have said, are you kidding me? What are you smoking? Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah?
Very different type of question. What's up with the lack of sleep in Zen practice?
What?
That's always been sort of a turnoff for me to do like extended Zen practice, because I value sleep so much and I think it's so helpful and needed and healthy, and I also have a really hard time meditating when I'm tired. So I'm just curious why.
Well, I actually said something about this before. Robert Aitken said that sleepy Zazen is really useful because your mind starts shorting out. He didn't say that, but something like that. Your mind doesn't interfere. I don't know if any of you have done long Zen retreats. A few of you have. Bix has, Jenny has. I don't know if you have, Aiden.
Residency.
Yeah. Oh, residency, right. And something mysterious starts happening on these long retreats, even short retreats. I don't know if you're noticing it now. Like, we're definitely not getting enough sleep. That's right, we're just not. But there is something we call Juriki. And it's got that word ki in it again, which is chi, which is, you know, the energy of the universe. And something starts happening for human beings who are on these extended retreats, that the practice begins to take over operating the human being. And it's an energy that's very weird, because we're still tired, but we stop falling asleep. I know there's always a time when, it doesn't happen as much anymore, but it always used to be that I would fall asleep around halfway through any retreat. It was 2 days, 7 days, 21 days, didn't matter. I would just be, you know, doing what we call bus meditation. Anybody doing that? And then it would stop. I was getting less sleep as time went on. And so this Juriki energy, it's very mysterious. And after a retreat is over, when we give guidelines tomorrow, Jenny's going to give us some guidelines, one of the things we say is make sure that you lie your body down. You won't go to sleep. You'll need less sleep, but your body really needs to rest. So people will buzz around and then collapse. So it's really nice to make sure you just lie down on a bed and close your eyes, even if you don't sleep. And gradually your system will get used to it. But yeah, it is a very mysterious thing. This awakening can happen when all of the usual ways that we have of guarding against the truth, I just can't put two thoughts together. I'm so tired. And then suddenly something will interfere and show up, a light on the floor, sound of a bird. It just cuts right through because there's nothing in the way.
And to take off that, you said, I can't meditate when I'm tired. And I would say that your idea of meditation is not matching what is actually happening right here, which is the real thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's in this room is meditating and doing it perfectly.
Yeah.
except one person. No, everybody. Right, how many of your minds just went, oh, she's talking about me? Thank you. Thank you. Well, just to say, too, that there's some Zen communities that get up even earlier than this. In fact, we usually do. We get up at least a half an hour earlier. We used to get up an hour and a half earlier. We didn't have rest periods, really short, just enough to get the dishes done and then back to the zendo. And we started to realize that in the afternoon it was almost a waste of time to sit because everybody was so exhausted. So we added this longer rest period, and now we have these various rest periods. And there's one tradition that we don't do it anymore. There used to be a 7-day retreat every December to celebrate the Buddha's awakening. And he just sat and sat and sat until he woke up, so he was a model of that. But in that retreat, every day of the 7 days, you go to bed an hour later and get up an hour earlier until basically you're not sleeping anymore. I did one retreat like that once, and it was a fantastic experience, but when we started creating Boundless Way, we said, we don't want to do that. That's just not, no, we're not doing it. So, so this is the middle way, is what we feel. I was saying that to one of you. There's real extremes and, macho run up mountains and don't ever sleep. And then there's very gentle, lovely Thich Nhat Hanh, who I've studied with, just do whatever you need to do, wander in and out. And then there's what we're doing, which is somewhere in the middle. And we have to find the right form for us. That's really important. So you might look around for a place where you get a little more sleep.
Yeah. On that note, about some traditions being macho, I feel like that's been sort of an experience I've had where like there just seems to be a macho quality to some traditions in Buddhism. I was wondering if you could comment on that.
Oh, just
yeah. I mean, yeah. There seems to be that, and just what Melissa said, the middle way. What works for you? What works for me? And what works for this sangha? No real right way, no real wrong way, but what works best. And this is a technology, as she said, of awakening, and we have to find the way that works for us.
Also, for myself, as a person who identifies as a woman, early on in my Zen career, it was pretty clear that women were not going to be teachers. There was something. I think I said this at the last retreat. I haven't said it here. The story about, yes, I did. The story about our Korean teacher's teacher who was doing a program. You were here for that. Yeah. Jenny was doing a program at the Providence Zen Center, this teacher, wonderful guy named Sung San, very, very macho person. And there are some writings, they were not original writings of Buddhism, they came a couple of hundred years later, that basically said women cannot be Buddhas. Right? This was everything was men or women, and women were like always down at the bottom of everything, especially in Zen. So somebody raised their hand and said, so I've heard that women can't be Buddhas, can't attain awakening. And he said, yes, that's true. And you know, it's like, what? And then he said, and men can't either. I love that story. And it stayed with me all these years. I was there when it happened. Because every time we put ourselves in some smaller container that divides us from others, we're not practicing the Dharma. Yeah. And we do that. This whole thing that Fraley was talking about, the world right now, it's very tribal. People are walling off against each other. So in Zen, we do have this practice of the non-dual, where there isn't anything opposed to anything else. And that feels very important. And now I am a Zen teacher. I'm still a woman. And there are a lot of women Zen teachers now. So years ago, that was impossible. Although one of my ancestors was a woman, who, but she, boy, she raked over the coals. She was called all kinds of names, pushy, bitchy, all this kind of stuff. It was pretty hard, but she persisted. That's Jew Kennett, that we chanted her name today. Really incredible person. And her first book that she wrote, I love this title. It's called Selling Water by the River. That's what Zen practice is. You already have it, but you know, sit for another 25 minutes. Thank you.
I think we have time for one more, if there's someone interested.
I was just going to ask, so if this like structure and like the timings and stuff of this retreat like are working for us, how would you recommend bringing this into like a practice like this into our daily lives? Like with all the distractions, all like the things you need to do, like it seems very hard to be able to hold like a space for yourself that's even remotely close to what you get here.
You start small. Come online. We're online. You know, we have practice set Monday through Friday, 7 a.m., and Tuesday, Thursday, and Sunday at 7 p.m. You can visit us online at boundlessway.org. And start small. Maybe come for 15 minutes, and then maybe a half an hour. And it's not easy, but it's definitely possible.
And this is formal practice.
Yeah.
Right. So informal practice, all through the day, you can stop, just stop, pause, take a breath. That would be enough. Remember what Hakuin said in the text we recited today? That if you hear this truth even once, if you sit even once, it's really true. Something starts shaking out in the world. This is the karmic ripples. And it'll shake out in your own life. Don't believe me, but I've certainly experienced it. For me, I go to as many of these retreats as I can. I go to all the sittings. It sets me up so that I don't have to think about stopping in my daily life. It just naturally starts happening. So we really encourage people to do formal practice until that starts happening. But meanwhile, start small. Yeah, this breath. One breath is enough. It's amazing. Red lights are great teachers. You know, you have to stop your car. No, I want to keep driving. Time to take a breath. Don't close your eyes, though.
Thank you, everyone. Please return the Zendo to its proper form.